Hello, welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, a Cinelinks podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the easiest way is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com. Of course, you can always find me on Twitter at stevedunk5 or at everythingcanon. Today in the show, we're talking to SB Divya all about her great new sci-fi book, Machinehood, which is being described as Zero Dark Thirty meets The Social Network in this science fiction thriller about artificial intelligence, sentience, and labor rights in a near future dominated by the gig economy. A thrilling and thought-provoking novel that asks, if we won't see machines as human, will we instead see humans as machines? We talk about all sorts of things related to those exact issues, the book, of course, and what technological pitfalls we as a species may or may not be facing in the coming decades. Warning, while this is definitely a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out. So, if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now. But definitely double back after you've had a chance to read it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always on this podcast, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, if we ever do that again, or each time we participate in the market with our purchasing choices. And this should, of course, occur all year long. I'm a little extra giddy today because I get to talk about a subject that I've been fascinated with for many years now, and my guest is a subject matter expert as far as I'm concerned, so this is a real treat. SB Divya is a lover of science, math, fiction, and the Oxford comma. I'm also a lover of those things. She is the Hugo and Nebula nominated author of Runtime and the short story collection Contingency Plans for the Apocalypse and Other Situations. She is the co-editor of the weekly science fiction podcast Escape Pod with Mer Lafferty. She holds degrees in computational neuroscience and signal processing and worked for 20 years as an electrical engineer in various fields, including pattern recognition, machine intelligence, high-speed communications, digital music, and medical devices, all before becoming an author. She's here today to talk about her new book, Machinehood, which is being described as Zero Dark Thirty meets The Social Network in the science fiction thriller about artificial intelligence, sentience, and labor rights in a near future dominated by the gig economy. Please welcome to the show, SB Divya. Hi, Divya.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. Dawns on me reading that quick intro bio there that could easily supplement the summary for Machinehood. I mean, let's be honest, you've been training your whole life to write this book, haven't you? I know it.
Yeah, pretty much.
Kind of, right? Yeah, those are all it's just funny, all those, you know, machine intelligence, obviously, pattern recognition for sure, but, you know, high-speed communications, digital, all this, medical devices, certainly, all are strong elements in Machinehood, and obviously we can't predict the future, but I got to say, it's worked out pretty well, I think.
Yeah, I didn't hold back.
I also love that you have a podcast with Mer. I spoke with her a couple of years ago about her Star Wars book, the Solo film adaptation she did. And we had a really great conversation about artificial intelligence. So
excellent.
Yes, she's great. I had a great time talking to her. It's been a while, and I really like that Star Wars book that she wrote. So yeah, that was kind of fun about that. I actually haven't heard that podcast, so I'm going to tune in, though, for sure after. I want to check it out.
Yeah, please do. Escape Pod has been around since 2005. It was the original science fiction podcast, though I am not a founder. I joined the team about 5 years ago.
Okay.
As a first reader, and then found myself in the editor's chair a couple of years later.
Yeah, I am going to check it out. I won't say ashamed, but it doesn't make any sense why I haven't listened to it yet, because I know it'll be right up my alley. So I'll definitely get to it for sure. So thank you very much for coming on the show. As always, during these times, I hope you and your family and friends are safe and healthy.
So far, so good. Thank
you. Okay, that's good. First question, what's your position on human life extension through artificial means? I'm just kidding. We are going to get to that, but not out of the gate. That's dumb. I do want to ask you one thing, though. It's kind of an interesting question. I think the Earth that you've created, the version of it, right? It's a future, near future Earth that you've created in Machinehood. I'm just wondering yourself, do you find it appealing? Like, to me nowadays, because, you know, the technology is exponential, right? The growth, and every time you create something, you inevitably give something up. So I'm just wondering, you know, could you live in the world that you yourself have created?
I could live in it. It would certainly not be my idea of a utopia or my ideal future in any sense. But just like the characters who inhabit this book, I could certainly live in that world and not hate it. It's not it's not a full dystopia either. You know, people are going about their lives, dealing with things just the way we are today, I feel like, and the way they did 100 or 200 years ago, taking the good with the bad.
Right. The one space station, is it Ekoyi? Ekoyai? How do you pronounce it?
Ekoyi.
Ekoyi. I'm an atheist myself, a longtime atheist and a vegan for a very long time. Sign me up. Like, I want to go there. even though I'm an atheist, like, yes, I'm an atheist, but like the tenets of Buddhism, so whether you're atheist, Catholic, Mormon, I don't care what your theism is. If you don't agree with the principles of the Four Noble Truths, then like, I think you basically suck. I mean, I don't understand how you couldn't, those are.
Interesting, Buddhism originally and in its underpinning philosophical values espoused by the Buddha is an atheist.
Right.
Belief system, let's say. And it's kind of been turned into more dogma and more religion, but yeah. It did not start out that way. And the Buddha was very adamantly against being worshipped, which I find deeply ironic in terms of what's happened today. But I think that probably has happened to a lot of religions, relative to their originators.
Especially as, like you said, as time goes on, so many new religions have popped up, whether you want to call them religions or not, I guess is up to you. But a lot of times it literally comes down to, people just disagreeing over a certain set of rules, essentially. And it, inspires someone to go off on their own and create a whole new set of rules, right?
Right. I feel like getting established in space, even if it's on space stations, is a great opportunity for setting up some new rules and new systems. And Eastern philosophical values and also indigenous philosophical values, I think, could find a really interesting place there.
I think so too. And it brings up an interesting point. It's like, what lengths would somebody or some people or a group of people or whatever, even a government or whoever, what lengths would they have to go to, if they were keen on creating a better society, we'll say, to escape the stench of, Earth, right? Is it a space station? Is it a planet down the road? You know what I mean? Like, it's an interesting idea, because inherently there's this idea that every act on Earth is a political one. So how do you, to escape that while staying on Earth seems impossible, doesn't it?
It does, but I would say an act in a new frontier type of space is still going to be a political one. It's just that maybe you have some different options. I think it would still be hard to leave behind Earth culture and tethers, like human beings are not often quick to change, and we have to take incremental steps. Mm-hmm. Even the establishment of something like the United States of America, which has ended up changing the world in a lot of ways, was incremental steps. And so I don't know that just because we leave the Earth physically behind, we're going to leave it behind, emotionally and psychologically and politically. I think a lot of that's going to go with us. And we're kind of seeing that already. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a decent amount of international cooperation with the ISS. But then you look at the Mars missions and, every country is sending its own, right?
I was just talking about this the other day with somebody about Mars in particular. By the time we actually get to a point where we're populating it, the first 10 years are going to be spent cleaning up all the junk that's there. Right? I mean,
yes, we're already littering on other parts of the solar system.
So as long as there's that human element, I think what you're saying is we're screwed, right? Okay, I got you.
No, you're right. More screwed than we have been.
Agreed. Yeah, for sure. And I do, this idea of a fresh start, though, and one of the ideas sort of in machinehood too is at no point is abandoning Earth an option.
No. And
it's all about fixing Earth, right? Saving Earth.
Yeah. I don't approve of abandoning Earth in general. Right. It's not one of my favorite narratives, because I think, It's very precious. We have co-evolved to live on this planet, in this ecosystem. We're not going to find something better. We might be able to engineer something almost as good, but even that is going to be challenging, just because natural selection, you know, is a decent process, even though it's one driven by random chance. Over enough time, in this case billions of years, it's worked out reasonably well. So I think it definitely behooves us to maybe do both. You know, natural curiosity and science has gotten us a very, very long way, and I think it will carry us further into space. But at the same time, we should definitely take care of our home planet.
And this sort of, I was going to ask, bring this up a little later, but this kind of actually is a nice transition, because one of the, you know, ideas in machinehood for sure is the, transhumanism. This idea that prolonging our lives through, you know, sort of artificial means and, you know, any way possible. And one of the quotes on your book, not a quote, a review, sorry, from Ray Kurzweil, of course, the popular transhumanist. And, you know, he said, from the opening manifesto to its ingenious technologies, machinehood built an inspiring and believable vision of the future that is both thought-provoking and hopeful. It will leave you wishing that tomorrow could arrive a little sooner. And as, you know, a leader in transhumanism, I have no doubt he believes that. What's your position on, are you a transhumanist? Do you like the idea of transhumanism, sort of, you know, extending our life extension at any means necessary type of thing? Not any means necessary. I don't mean, you know, to the sacrifice of other people, but.
I embrace the idea of allowing humanity to move past just our biology and right. physiology. I think it should be a choice. I think there hopefully, you know, isn't a new kind of classism or racism built out of that, though it will be a struggle to avoid. I would hope that, you know, in a positive vision of a transhumanist future, we allow for a spectrum of existences, anywhere from, you know, completely biological to completely artificial. And I think we're kind of already somewhat there. I know, you know, people poo-poo this idea that things like pacemakers or deep brain stimulators or even your smartwatch are basically the beginnings of, you know, the cyborgation of human beings, right?
Right.
That we are starting to incorporate machines into our lives. And just because our cell phones live in our pockets and not in our abdomen doesn't make them any less essential a part of what we need to live, work, and play. And so I feel like it's already happening. It's just happening in ways that are more subtle than you often see in, you know, manga or science fiction. You know, we're not walking around yet like the Borg with big, bulky, obvious machine parts all over our body.
Right.
But we are walking around, you know, many of us with a machine attached to our hips at
right.
all times.
Right.
And it's hard and sometimes scary to leave those behind. I have some hills right next to my house. I'm very fortunate, especially in the middle of this pandemic, to have hiking trails walking distance. And I often would leave my phone behind and go for a walk. And at one point my spouse was like, I've been trying to call you. Why did you not have your phone? It's like, I was taking a walk in nature and kind of being with my own thoughts. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
But it's become expected, right? And there was one time I got stung by a bee, and we do have rattlesnakes, and I didn't know if I was allergic. So that was a little, you know, iffy for a few minutes where I kind of did wish I had my phone. What if I need to call 911? What if a snake bites me, you know? So we've already started transitioning away from purely human, even though we don't think of it that way, in a lot of very nuanced ways we're on that road.
Right. And this sort of, you know, humans have been fascinated with this idea for a long time. I mean, you can go back to the, you know, early 1900s when there was that famous play, I think it was a Russian play, Yeah, right. That was in the early 1900s, right? So, and then
Czechoslovakian,
or was it Czechoslovakia? Okay,
yeah, I believe so.
And then, you know, go down the list from there. You get to, you know, iRobot and Metropolis actually not long after that, and then iRobot, and you know, the Asimovs and the Bradburys, and you know, we've been fascinated with this idea, certainly robotics and stuff like that, and enhancing the human condition that way for a long time now. And it's funny to me because I'm 45 years old, so I remember pre-cell phone and all that stuff, right? So I remember
me too.
Yes, I remember, you know, just what, like you said, going out into the world without a means of communication, you know, other than with nature. So it's interesting to me with this newest generation where, like you said, you know, the phones, a phone, I'd never thought of it that way, as a phone being sort of this this way of enhancing the human condition in that type of sense.
Yeah, I think phones, antibiotics.
You know, because you're right. Yeah,
a lot of the pharmaceuticals we take, also in terms of life extension, have definitely extended our lives, right?
Sure.
And these are all things that are not always naturally obtained.
Right.
That doesn't make them bad, in my opinion. It just makes it something that we're using, you know, science and technology to extend and expand beyond our natural confines.
And again, to your point, I know people whose phone doesn't leave their hand, so it might as well be attached to
right.
in some physical, surgically way. In my review, I said, historically, where loss of control, self-worth, and self-determination enter the picture, so too does ignorance, self-righteousness, and fear. This is as complicated as it sounds and is as fraught with peril as you might expect. Because anytime you have an AI philosophically laden story, you're bound to get a heavy dose of social commentary, and it usually skews dire. Mostly speaking about myself, because we talked a little bit before we started recording here. I've been fascinated with artificial intelligence and singularities and stuff for a long time. A lot of this is, like I said, you know, we let our imaginations sort of get the better of us, me certainly. So I'm counting on you to sort of talk me off the ledge here, because I'm one of these people that absolutely believes once machines become self-aware, they're going to, you know, look at us. We're just bags of water, right? Like we need food. We need rest. We break easily. Like we're kind of useless in so many ways. And I understand it's a very cynical and simplistic way to look at it. And I understand both conversations are happening around the world concurrently. We're embracing this idea of this technology that could provide untold amounts of positive things for the world. There's no doubt about it. But we know they're also preparing for Skynet, you know, and this idea that whoever develops it first, unless there's an agreement in place, international agreement, their principles, their values will be the guiding development and use of artificial intelligence, right?
I don't know if I completely agree with that. And I really don't buy into the Skynet, Terminator, Matrix view of our AI future, even if they do become sentient and self-aware. Mostly because I think what we're doing is projecting the worst aspects of human nature and human fears onto the intelligent machines. And it doesn't strike me as very realistic, honestly, because what's in it for the AIs to obliterate us when, you know, more likely they can make use of us the way we do with all of our natural resources, right? Human beings will be another resource if the AIs do somehow become self-aware, grow into something greater than human beings. I don't think the first step is going to be to kill us all, because that's just a waste of their energy and time and perfectly good labor force that exists and, you know, is quite capable of doing a lot of stuff, right?
See, we're not a good labor force, though, not compared to what general artificial intelligence machine could produce, certainly.
It's true, but I think I don't know if I'm convinced again that somehow AIs are going to become superior or even feel that they need to be.
Superior.
Like, I think that's very human, this idea of, you know, somehow being alpha is very biological. It's very primate driven too. Like, there's other types of life on Earth that don't think and behave that way. So I don't know that artificial intelligences will be human-like, right? They might have their own motivations. I actually, probably my favorite depiction of AI in Hollywood in recent times is the movie Her, where they're just like, you know, we've had enough of you and we're moving on.
Right.
Right. Like, yep. They're just not going to care.
Right. Yeah.
Unless
well,
we
that's
get in their way.
Well, but isn't that the point that they aren't going to care? Right. you know what I mean?
And listen,
I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not, this is just me watching too many movies and reading too, like, you know, James Barrett's book, Our Final Invention, right? Like that's just me. And, you know, I more share your opinion. I think, you know, the right people are doing the right work and we're going to be fine. But just this idea that, you know, it all comes down to what job do you assign the AI, I suppose. And let's say, for example, it's to combat climate change. And it decides that, you know, the number one effector of climate change is human beings. Right?
Yeah, but so, we still have the ability to pull the plug.
Well, that's the end of the day, right? That is sort of what I meant earlier too about the conversations that are happening, right? Like being prepared I'm more than confident we're prepared for that eventuality. Just I just really, like I said, it's more of just an influence of too much, for sure, too much pop culture and stuff like that. But I certainly don't think Skynet just because that's like the fun, easy pull right from that shelf, but I certainly don't think, and besides, machines wouldn't make those machines. They're useless too, right? The Terminator ones. they're incredibly inefficient as well. So
I always wondered about that. I'm like, you have this vast capable AI and this is what it's going to send, is this like humanoid robot with legs?
Right. Well, it's not even going to be a robot probably, right? It'll be a weird nano drone swarm or something, and then they'll be affecting. But there's this funny anecdote I read one time, I can't remember who wrote it, it's years ago, but they just said, we're just one summer student forgetting to unplug the machine at the end of the day away, you know, from the singularity, but by the next morning we're all screwed. But
That was a very popular idea, especially in the 90s. And right. I will admit to falling to that one myself, idea that if we just make it complicated enough, you know, consciousness will emerge naturally.
Right.
And I think we're already discovering in terms of real software that, nah, that's probably not true. Like, just because we have trillions of connections in our deep neural network doesn't mean it's spontaneously going to become self-aware.
Right.
It's just going to be that much better at playing games at the end of the day. Right?
Right,
things that
right,
are
right.
very predictable but right. complex.
Right.
And that's where, you know, AI exceeds our own capacity, because we have a lot of attention-gated mechanisms in the brain. And so we're easily distracted, which is good. It's a survival mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
But it means that we can't, you know, follow every decision tree down to its very, very last branches and come up with every possible scenario, because we can't hold all that in our heads, whereas the machines can.
Right.
But at the end of the day, that's not sentience and self-awareness. That's actually, it's one of the reasons why in machinehood I try to make these distinctions between different types of artificial intelligence, because I think, you know, the shortcut, even in today's conversation with a lot of businesses, they like to throw around that they're using AI and everything is AI driven. And it bothers me as someone working in that space, because what do you mean by AI? When you tell someone on the street AI, they're immediately going to think Terminator,
because
that's their conception of it, right? And it's like, that's not what's powering Facebook's, you know, newsfeed algorithm. There's not a killer robot or anything close behind that software structure. It is very, very complicated. We don't always have an intuitive understanding or a closed form mathematical understanding of what's happening, but we absolutely know what structure we have built and how to fool it and how to improve it. And so what we're building right now, in my opinion, are just really sophisticated statistical pattern recognition systems.
Right.
And there is no model yet in neuroscience of what it means to be conscious and self-aware, and a lot of the things that our frontal cortex does, and we know there's some physical structure there that's building it for ourselves, but that qualitative sense of I exist and I think and I'm separate from the people around me, that's not something we quite yet understand. And until we do, I think we're going to have a hard time building it into software, A, and B, recognizing it in an artificial intelligence as something legitimately equal to humankind.
Right. And to, just to put a pin in that conversation too, and you mentioned it because I was going to just say the same thing, you know, it's odd that we are so quick to apply consciousness to a machine when we don't even understand consciousness yet really ourselves, not in a, like you said, a, you know, in an application situation, right?
Right. Even philosophically though, I would right. say, you know, people argue about whether like a roly-poly, like a pill bug, is conscious, right? Is it conscious? Is it just, you know, moving through like a very sophisticated little robot, or does it have any self-awareness? And if we go really deep into that particular rabbit hole, how do I know you have self-awareness?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yep. Human beings have been philosophizing about this for, you know, thousands of years, probably since we had the capacity to have the language for these types of conversations.
Right.
You know, this goes way back, right? Where we're kind of like, how do I understand reality? How do I understand myself? And I think these are really interesting questions. I don't know that I agree that artificial construction needs to have the same kind of consciousness as a human being in order to be considered an intelligent person of its own.
Right.
And that's a question I'm still personally wrestling with, but I do wonder, you know, as we love to hypothesize about aliens in science fiction, we always figure we'll know life if we see it, because it'll behave like us, like somehow it'll, you know, be self-protective, it'll want to reproduce, it'll possibly want to, you know, kill and enslave us or trade goods with us or something, right? But that we'll know, because we generally know, looking at the planet and the other life forms on Earth, whether something is alive or dead. And it's, but I think that's something intuitive we've developed by living on Earth. And so I do wonder, you know, if we build that software in its own way to be its own kind of super intelligence, are we going to recognize that it is a legitimate form of life? Or are we always going to be hung up on the fact that, you know, nothing gave birth to it, that it was built up by human beings from parts? And so that's sort of the, I think, the more real ethical conundrum we're likely to face in the next 100 years or so.
Right. And that speaks to us being sort of unique in the universe so far anyways. And to your point, Earth being unique, and we should take care of it and try to right to your point earlier, right? And then this, again, we're talking, you know, this sort of goes back to like the Turing test, for example, or, you know, movies like Ex Machina that really challenged that, you know, idea, exactly what you just said about, you know, you have somebody like Ava, right, who is very obviously a machine. And yet this thing in humans, what are we able to recognize, decipher by looking at Ava, and just because she's, you know, expresses a thought, let's say, or even expresses an emotion, we don't know if she feels it. How are we able to wrap ourselves around that as a species and, you know, determine, are we even allowed to determine that? Whose job is it to determine that? But anyways, these are many of the issues that come up in Machinehood, the book which you are here to discuss, which I absolutely...
That's okay.
Yeah, that's, you put all this stuff in the book, so I think it's fair game. Which I loved Machinehood, by the way, a lot. I thought it was really, 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 really great. Unfortunately, the summary is really long, so I'm not going to read it.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, and you must have your elevator pitch down to a science at this point, so why don't you tell us what Machinehood is about.
Yeah, Machinehood is basically a near future political techno thriller with underpinnings of, you know, questions about sentience, questions about the labor force, the conflict between humans and machines and automation that we see today carried forward. And in terms of characters, fundamentally about two women on opposite sides of the globe, one who is very much a physical fighter, action hero type, but the other who is very much the quiet scientist, domestic type, and how their stories interweave with this shadowy new organization, the Machinehood, agitating for machine rights and generally creating chaos around the world.
You say it so lovely. You have such a beautiful speaking voice. It's like just generally creating chaos around the world. It's like you're luring me to sleep before they come and burn my house down. Who are you more like?
I'm definitely more the domestic science type for sure. The two characters, you know, Nithya, the action Welga, heroes, yeah. Welga, yep. Yeah, and Nithya is the one in India who's the more domestically oriented.
Yeah, sure.
And Welga is everything I would love to be. I'm an enthusiastic outdoorsy kind of person in terms of, you know, I like hiking, I like snowboarding, I've scuba dived, I've mountain biked, but I'm not particularly skilled at any of these things.
Right.
I'm not very strong. I just like being outside and I like trying and doing stuff, but I wish I was, you know, more kick-ass and more capable of taking physical risks, of being a lot more graceful. I have no intuition when it comes to my body. I have to be highly trained and educated to like move my limbs in certain ways. But I do appreciate people who can be athletic, who can really kind of take advantage of their physiology and do more than the average person. And that is probably because I spend a lot of time in my head. So I'm much more like Nithya. I have a kid, I have a household, you know, I spend a lot of time in front of a computer doing code and thinking about stuff, and not nearly enough time inhabiting my physical spaces.
Right. See, I'm the same as you. I don't do anything athletic. You do a lot of things athletic. You just wish you were better at it, I guess is what you're saying. Or had maybe had more time to do it.
Kind of both.
I'm fine with that. I don't do any of that stuff. I do scuba dive. I'm a fair weather scuba diver. I've actually scuba dived for decades now, but I'm a fair weather one. Like only when if I have to wear a wetsuit, I don't want to do it.
I'm with you. I live in Southern California and I refuse to scuba dive in our local waters because it's too cold for me.
Well,
I prefer where it's warm.
But I'm in Toronto, so you won't get me. When I got my certification a long time ago up here, you do it in lakes, Great Lakes and stuff that. And you hit that thermocline and you wish you were somewhere else real quick. I'm perfectly fine with not making the most of this, as I say, a bag of water. I'm okay with that. I think I said in my review, I am Team Nithya all the way. She's fantastic for a lot of reasons, and we'll talk about her and well, go a little bit more in a second. I read a couple of reviews after I posted mine, just to kind of see what everybody, get the temperature of the water. And there was a couple that, and this isn't to, you know, I'm not trying to dump on you at all, because you know I love the book. A couple of reviews that said they just couldn't connect or didn't care about the characters necessarily, that they were sort of maybe overshadowed by the abundance of tech. I completely disagree with them. I actually think you wrote that very fine line extremely well, but it is a fine line. And I think it's a valid point to make insofar as I think it's a good question to ask you. So this is a process sort of question, right? You must have been aware when you were writing this book, too much tech, not enough tech. Because it is a fiction, right? It's not nonfiction. It's not nonfiction. It's a story. There's a story here with characters. There's a beating heart to this book, right? That goes beyond all the wonderful tech that is in this book. Talk about that a little bit, just sort of when you were coming up with this idea for this book, and that there is that sort of fine line.
Yeah, it's interesting with science fiction. You know, there's always this spectrum of how deep do you get into the world building and, you know, the science and technology that you're inventing and the details therein versus how much time do you spend with the characters and the plot? And I'm not saying you can't do both, but then, you know, you might end up with 1,000 pages instead of more reasonably digestible 400 pages, and your publisher is just going to say no. Some of that just comes down to the readership too. You know, there's people who love like the deep technical stuff, right? Who want, you know, every page of Tom Clancy's description of every weapon, or Kim Stanley Robinson's description of, you know, how a particular planet or asteroid works. And then there are those people who get bored of those things, or just, you know, find it over their heads and not interesting. And so they prefer the fun kind of science fiction where it's more about the characters and the plot. And it is a line that, you know, every author is going to have to choose where their particular comfort is, and then it finds that audience. So I did try to balance, you know, where my own interests were in terms of the technology. You know, how much do I want to delve into explaining this technology to people via the story versus how many pages I want to spend, not just on plot and characters, but really on the themes. You know, my hope with Machinehood is that it provokes people to question their assumptions.
Right.
And, you know, I've seen some user type reviews or reader type reviews that really amuse me, because there will be people who love the book and say, you know, this book really made me think a lot. And there are people who didn't like the book because this book made me think a lot. And so, so I don't expect, you know, Machinehood to be like a runaway commercial success, because a lot of people don't pick up a novel in order to think a lot. You know, they want, they just want to escape and have fun for a few hours, and that's totally fine. I do too. But other times I do want a book that makes me, you know, ask questions about the world around me, or, you know, my own underlying assumptions about humanity. And so those are the kind of people, or when you're in that mood, you know, that's when you pick up hopefully a book like Machinehood and you walk away continuing to think about it. That's sort of the biggest compliment that people give me, maybe unintentionally, is after I put the book down, I was thinking about it, you know, for the next several days, or it keeps coming back to me when I read something in the news. And I absolutely love that. So hopefully I hit the sweet spot for, you know, some segment of the science fiction audience in terms of how much information and detail I give about this very rich world of 2095, and how much time we spend with these characters in the actual sort of fun thriller action driven plot.
Yeah, and that's sort of the idea, because like you said, it's set in 2095, far away, but not that far away in the grand scheme of the universe. So what I would just, and to that point, what I would say to people out there who haven't read the book, this book is, it's really dense. You know, there's a lot going on all the time. I don't feel like you ever let up, which is fine for me anyways. So I would just encourage people, like if they're feeling sort of weighted down at the beginning, just stick with it. This book has a huge payoff if you get through the end. And I sort of like, you know, equated it to, I've seen people, you know, like the technical, I called it bibble babble, but that's just me because I'm an idiot. But it's no different than immersing yourself in any fantasy world that has its own language or customs or culture, right? Like your brain just has to, it's the Sapir-Whorf theory. Your brain just has to adjust. And once you sort of get accustomed to the world that you yourself have created in Machinehood, I think people will be fine. So just stick, anyone out there, just stick with it. You'll be fine. Trust me. One of the things too, that sort of, and this is where like, I think the needle keeps moving here on this point. So it's 2095, and in your book, WAIs, weak artificial intelligence, are quite advanced, certainly compared to what we have today. Like I would consider, maybe not anymore, and you definitely please correct me on this, you know, a weak artificial intelligence to me is a calculator, right? So, you know what I mean? So
I would say a calculator is not any kind of AI. It is a completely deterministic system. There is nothing, but there's no uncertainty in there whatsoever. And a hallmark of machine learning systems is that they are based on probability and statistics. And so there has to be a degree of error and uncertainty and unpredictability, especially while you're training it. Maybe after you're done training it, if it stops adapting, it becomes a static system, not that different from a calculator. But things like calculators, things like decision trees for chess, where you can just look at every single possible move and then make a choice that's naturally optimal. These are, to me, not really machine intelligence systems. These are just really good, complicated software systems.
I see.
Or in the case of calculators, maybe hardware systems. Machine learning, to me, the critical piece of that is the learning, right? In terms of, you know, machine intelligence also is that it's capable of learning and adapting to an unpredictable environment, not 100% unpredictable, right? So we've given it some degree of context, some degree of training, we've given it a certain goal, and then within that structure, it has a degree of flexibility and adaptability so that it's not always going to do the same thing given the same stimulus.
Right.
And without that, I don't think we can call it any kind of artificial intelligence, even the weakest form. The weakest AI we have today, you know, and they're getting better, right? And we have these specialized spheres of things like convolutional neural networks that are good at image processing, you know, things like the GPT systems and generative adversarial networks that are good for other specific applications, including natural language processing. So we have pieces of the puzzle for what people in the industry are now calling artificial general intelligence, which is to be able to put all of these things into one configuration that can be applied to any of them. So rather than having a very specific software or hardware architecture to do games or to do language or to do vision or to do audio, we have one structure, much like the brain, that could be applied to any of these. And that's, I think, the current goal in terms of research that's happening in, you know, machine intelligence is artificial general intelligence. That still doesn't, to me, get us to sentient artificial intelligence, right?
Right.
Which is a term I coined specifically from machinehood, in part because acronyms are being invented all the time in reality. And I wanted to get ahead of where we are today rather than using something that in 10 years is going to be obsolete. Previously, you know, people were talking about weak AI and strong AI. And so initially I was going to go with strong AI for machinehood. And then I decided against it because we were already moving on to what does strong AI really mean? So how about instead we just talk about general intelligence as in general purpose and let the consciousness and sentience and emotional stuff, you know, be its own bucket.
So you're saying if a calculator got it wrong once in a while, then it would be considered AI?
Yes. You know, think about how many times we make mistakes. I will cop to it myself. Like I love calculus and I'm abysmal at arithmetic. I make mistakes all the time.
Right. Hear that, calculators? If you want to fool us, just get some. Yeah, yeah. One of the things in machinehood is, and my point was that, like, so, you know, in 2095, you know, WAIs are sort of the dominant thing as far as supposed to make life easier for, you know, for people, right? They sort of replace us in many of, like, a lot of menial tasks and different things like that. But what the human race has decided and what's become available in machinehood is sort of like these what you call VMODs, right? These people who augment their body with machine parts. And one of the other dominant things in machinehood is these zips, juvers, flow, all these different things that a human can take, which makes them, it either can suppress certain things, but it ideally the general purpose is to make them better at a certain thing too, right?
Yeah, I had the conception of smart pills that are not just chemicals, but that actually have, you know, micro and nano machines that can interact with your body. And this is a thing that we are working on today. Pills you can swallow that will help people see inside your stomach and intestines, or take biopsy samples without having to go in surgically. This is a good thing. But with Machinehood, I took those ideas and extended them into the consumer sphere. You know, what happens if this becomes widespread, and if it can have a whole economy built around it?
And that is sort of like really a lot of the basis of Machinehood, as far as the story part comes into play, right? So we learn that, you know, this has been in place now for decades at this point, and we slowly learn that this maybe isn't the best route to go for some people, you know, depending on their genetic makeup. And this is where we enter the sort of like, there's a really great just like geo-conspiracy government thing going on with Machinehood. I try not to say too much here without spoilers, but this is the grab them part of the story where, you know, you're trying to get people engaged to a point where you create sympathy for certain characters in this book, Welga being one of them. So this idea that, you know, like you said, sort of we're working on these incredible things that we're going to be able to do with these pills and stuff like that. And, you know, we've always had pills that, like uppers, I guess, right, that keep, you know, we hear about military has pills that keep their soldiers wired and awake for days and days at a time. And right. Our blessed truck drivers have been taking uppers,
let's not forget the entire world that's addicted right. to caffeine.
So this idea that, and you said, you know, just that thing you just mentioned about being able to sort of like see inside of, you know, human body and stuff like that. And I think Machinehood is sort of like in a way speaks to the balance of the book that you wrote, which I think you wrote just perfectly. You're careful to explain, I think, both sides of the argument of the debate, if there was a debate to be had. It's not only, of course, the obvious benefits that come from it, but it's a cautionary tale, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we see that today, right?
Yeah.
You know, we've had alcohol, we've had cigarettes, we've had opioids, and even coffee for some of us. I love coffee, but I had to give up caffeinated coffee because it was giving me headaches. And so, you know, not all human beings are built the same way. Even though we're all built from DNA, everyone has their unique biochemistry and ways of reacting to these substances. And then we have, you know, just all the carcinogens in our lives, right? We make these trade-offs a lot of times without really thinking about it, just because it's our reality. You know, you eat the food you eat, you drink the water you drink, you breathe the air you breathe, and not all of these things are necessarily good for your body, but you don't necessarily have a choice either. You know, you have to eat, drink, and breathe. And so I wanted to highlight that, but obviously through a more fun science fictional lens, and look at what are these everyday things of the future that the people in 2095 take for granted, but may not always work for everyone in society, may have detrimental effects for some people, may conflict with certain situations or times in their lives when, you know, they have to make a choice. And I think human beings have made these choices, you know, throughout history, right? Consciously or unconsciously, every single person is making these choices on a daily basis. And many people are left feeling like they don't have good choices. I was reading a piece recently on, you know, what they call food deserts in urban areas, where higher end groceries that provide organic produce, for example, or certain types of health foods, just don't establish storefronts there because they don't think the people in that locale have enough money to shop at their stores. So those people then just don't have easy access to certain types of food. And it's these sorts of little things that, you know, I look at from today and try to kind of project out into this future and apply the same types of conflicts, but to a different type of situation. And yet I hope that, you know, people will see that sort of symbolism and those underlying questions and be like, oh yeah, you know, if I was in Welga's shoes, like, what would I do, right? And then kind of think back to like, what do I do today? You know, if you're an alcoholic, what do you do? So I think it's universal human struggles put into a science fictional context.
Sure. And this idea that technology, advancement of technology, all these things, automation is supposed to make life easier, isn't necessarily the case all the time, especially when it comes to things like income equality and of course classism and all that other stuff. But talk about that with machinehood, sort of how, I mean, if you were to ask most people right now, they're like, what do you envision 2095 like? And they would, I don't know, come up with Tomorrowland or something, or I don't know, right?
Flying cars. It's always flying cars.
Right. Whatever we, in the 80s, we thought 2020 was going to look like, right? That's, right. You know, we've seen all the, what was the World's Fair and stuff like that, right? Where they had all these wonderful things. You're careful there, though, to not say, no, it's not, it can go a lot of different ways, and don't, you know, necessarily think that, you know, just because we have these technologies that life will suddenly improve for X billion people.
Yeah, that was me, again, kind of looking back at history and then projecting certain trends I see today, and especially economically, you know, a lot of people are having this conversation right now in the spaces I inhabit about what are the jobs of, you know, mid-century going to look like, because we are going through an upheaval thanks to automation, thanks to digitization. And we went through a very similar upheaval about 100 years ago when we moved from a primarily agrarian economy to one that was more industry. And it was not fun. You know, we went through the Great Depression. People lost a lot of jobs. We had to invent public schools as a system, right? And get people used to the idea that their children are going to sit in a room and just learn for 6 hours a day, and that that's okay. They're not going to be out, you know, plowing the fields and feeding the farm animals and learning how to slaughter chickens anymore. I think we're going through a transitional period again right now. And that is scary for a lot of people because they don't necessarily have the skills or the foresight to know what's coming. And we're still figuring out, you know, the equivalent of the public school system in terms of how do we enable our human workforce to be adaptable to this coming future. And in machinehood, you know, I took certain tracks in terms of how we get from today to 2095. And obviously there are infinite possibilities. So I had to choose, you know, as an author, what this particular future is going to look like. And chances are it's going to look nothing like that. And that's totally fine, because in a lot of ways, it's a book about today as much as it is, you know, about 2095. And in terms of this sort of looming conflict between, you know, very intelligent software systems, increasingly capable robots, and human beings, I really wanted to picture, you know, what does work look like in 2095? And so I smashed up a few different things. You know, I took the gig economy and continued that forward. I took the makerspace and 3D printing and took that considerably forward to where, you know, we don't need factories anymore. We don't need corporations anymore. People have a lot of flexibility to make things in their own home. And
like,
so
like vaccines, which I thought like was a, which is a great line. I wrote it down. Imagine how much worse it would be today if we couldn't make vaccines in our kitchens. I mean, imagine how, talk about a real world.
So funny. Yeah. I wrote Machinehood in 2017 and 2018. And then I was editing it, you know, last year before publication, and reading through some of that stuff, I was just like, gosh, wow, I didn't expect this to be so relevant so soon.
They never do. They never do.
Yeah, so things like that, you know, I kind of mashed all that together and got rid of corporations, turned everyone into contract workers, which horrifies some people. But I think other people find that, you know, not necessarily a bad thing, even today, but also, you know, the people of 2095 in this story, and try to really come up with capitalism, but a very different sort of economic cycle than what we're used to.
It's tough to talk about the Dakini without spoilers. And I really don't want to do that, because that's a really important part of the book that I think people should really discover on their own. But there's a really great line from one of the Dakini, I'll just say, Clements, who says, you know, their goal is to erase the boundaries between different intelligences, to let everyone fall on a spectrum rather than distinct categories. I think that's a really interesting idea, and I am in love with it. Do you think that, is that plausible?
I'm in love with the idea too, which is why I put it in there. I hope we get there. I genuinely think that, you know, the more humanity can learn respect of all things, not just all people, the better off life is going to be in the long run. Like, you know, empathy and compassion are awesome, but I think the third piece of that particular puzzle to me is respect. And if we can get there, I think that would be a pretty great future, you know, to inhabit. And will we get there? I don't know. I think it'll be really interesting to see, you know, how we move forward, how we kind of overcome the systematic incentive structures that we have right now that push us away from some of those values, especially in terms of consumer culture and, although I hate to say it, Western religions in a lot of ways, that push us to particular value systems. And I think there are other ways that we can have cultures that will enable us to move into this future where, yeah, all intelligence and all life is allowed to exist on a spectrum, and its value is not tied to where it falls on that spectrum. One of the things I've kind of talked about with other people here and there in terms of these themes and philosophical ideas underpinning machinehood is the idea of human exceptionalism, that, you know, we're special and therefore we should be allowed to do things, you know, differently for ourselves than for anything else. And that's where I kind of point at the dominant Western religions right now.
Right.
You know, God created man, right? And so human beings and men especially are very, very special and therefore have the right to exploit the rest of the world. Like, God created Earth to serve us, versus a lot of indigenous philosophies, a lot of Eastern philosophies that are, you know, saying more that, you know, life is life. You can be reborn as anything, so watch what you do. or, you know, that all things, even inanimate things, even abstract things like rivers and mountains, have a spirit, have a soul, have some sort of personification, and therefore have value that are equal to or possibly even greater than humans. And therefore, we should treat them with respect and equality. And so that's kind of what fueled some of my thinking when, you know, I turned around and applied this to AI. And I think this is where, like, going all the way back to the beginning of our conversation with, you know, Skynet and Terminator and Ex Machina, where we assume that, oh God, the robots are going to be like us and think that they are exceptional and that therefore, you know, humans are worthless, right? What if we instill these other types of values into the AI and espouse it ourselves, right? So then they're going to look at human beings as just another part of the fabric of the universe and treat us with respect. And hopefully we're treating them with respect, right? And it's sort of a mutual appreciation of everything that we are rather than an inherent competition for, you know, resources and drive to exceed and dominate.
And I think you get your point across in machinehood, everything you just said, which was beautiful and, like, sign me up, where, you know, show me that planet. if it ends up being Earth, great. But you expressed a lot of that a couple of different ways in Machinehood, and I don't want to keep you way too much longer, but Aotera, is that how you say your name?
I would say Aotara, but
Aotara. Sort of espouses a lot of that language, and then through the Machinehood Manifesto, which are, you know, which you present as epigraphs throughout this book. And unless I'm missing pages, you don't give us all of them.
I don't.
Okay.
I have it.
Can I have them?
It's good reading.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I'm with it. I would be in the Machinehood, I feel like, after I read them all, or the ones
I
you
did
give
write
us.
The
I wrote them all out, by the way.
Oh, did you? I'll send you the whole thing. But I'm planning at some point. I have a site.
There is a Machinehood site, yeah.
Right, machinehood.com.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that now the book is out, I might put the full manifesto behind like a password protected page, and just have it be a fun password that you have to find somewhere in the book.
So. I love that. I'm looking at them. I wrote all of them out, and I don't. How many did you even
do?
I'm
so impressed.
Yes, I did type them all out. I'm looking at them. But then I realized when I got to the end how, imagine my anger.
Where's most of it?
Especially as I'm reading the book and I can see the page count winding down and I'm like, I still need 2, 4, you know, like I'm looking at the numbers. That's really all I want. I don't even have a question there. But yeah, the question would have been, you know, tell me this idea behind the manifesto and Aotera. And you just sort of said that with everything you just said. And you know, the basis for this idea about respecting all things. I mean, that's the gig sort of, isn't it? With Machinehood.
Yeah, that's the hope. That's really, if there's a takeaway, you know, some people have criticized the novel or just questioned, you know, me personally as to what do I think, what's the answer,
right,
to a lot of these questions that I've raised. And some people are annoyed that I don't present an answer clearly by the end of the book.
Right.
And that is in part because, you know, I do think it's a bit of an idealistic vision of the future. I don't know that we're going to get there because human nature is human nature. And it's very, very varied. Not everyone is going to agree that the right way forward is, you know, to treat each other with compassion, empathy, and respect. And so my hope is that people at least consider this as, you know, a plausible alternative and a more positive way forward. And so I don't want to be prescriptive. I'm not trying to invent a new religion.
But
I do kind of want people to be like, oh yeah, you know, I never really thought about it that way, right? Like maybe we could build a world. Maybe we could build a different 2095 that doesn't look like Machinehood, or a 2195 that, you know, looks better than Machinehood in a lot of ways. And the manifesto was a really fun thing to write. I tried not to drink my own Kool-Aid as I was writing it. But, you know, some of me is definitely in there, and some of what I believe, and some of what, like I said, I just hope, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the really fun thing about Machinehood is that, you know, let's just have an in-universe conversation for a second. In their world, 29.5 would be a marker, wouldn't it? Because if, you know, people will understand this once they read the book, but, you know, when you get to the end of the book, they're on the cusp of profound change.
Potentially.
It's hard to talk about without spoilers, isn't it? This is where the Dakani come in too, but this is the thing with your book, which I like very much, is that, you know, you ask a lot of questions that are completely relevant to 2021. And that's where I love a character like Nithya. So Nithya, like you said, the book is sort of follows two paths for the most part, these sisters, Welga and Nithya. And each of their stories could be a book, because what Welga encounters and tackles and what Nithya encounters and tackles are, of course, connected in specific ways, are also just incredibly complicated, interesting stories unto themselves. Did you at one point, was this ever going to be more than one book? Was this just like, what was the idea? Because it is, there's enough there for, you know, for a duology at least. And talk about Nithya for a little bit.
Yeah. It's funny that, so let me answer your questions bit by bit. This book was always intended to be one book and, to tell a complete story for these two characters. I think the best books, in my opinion, always leave the door open for more and hopefully leave you wanting to spend more time with these characters and to know more about their lives. I think, every single person in the world has a story that would fill 10 volumes, right? If you tried to tell the story of their life. And so, of course, I had to pick and choose as an author what's important to like this particular slice of this particular story. Will there be more books set in the world of Machinehood? That will probably be mostly contingent on how well Machinehood does for my
Of
publisher.
course.
I could certainly go back and, continue the story, tell other stories. I think there's a lot of other types of people in Machinehood whose stories I didn't have a chance to get into at all, and it would be really interesting to kind of see how they move through that particular world. I tend to be, I'm going to digress for a second and say I tend to be the kind of author who likes to just jump from one cool idea to the next. So revisiting a world isn't something I have done yet ever. So it would be interesting to do. My 11-year-old was like, "When are you going to write like, a series?" And I said, "I don't know if I'm ever going to write a series. I don't know if that's me or if I would just rather, have a new set of thought-provoking questions to ask in a whole new world." But we'll see. A lot of it just depends on practical business stuff. But back to the characters, especially Nithya's character, I decided to put her in because I feel like not enough science fiction looks at everyday life. We come up with these like fantastic, awesome worlds, and we always center the stories around the people who are at the forefront of the action, which makes sense, right? It's very exciting. But there's always, in my mind at least, like, what's everybody else doing? While the heroes are out battling the aliens, like, what's, the person at home with the 3-year-old doing? That's not the 3-year-old getting rescued by the superhero, but that's just the them being at home, dealing with and watching, the fallout on around the planet, and how do you cope? And I think that's an equally interesting story, and it kind of gives you a richer sense of what it's like to inhabit that science fictional world, because the hero of the story is very busy being a protagonist, and being active and solving problems and dealing with bad guys, whatever. But because they are so busy doing those things, they're not making dinner. They're not, going to the store. It's like, so how in this world, would you live if you were just a regular person? And that's really where I brought in Nithya, right? She has a connection to the action hero of the story. They are sisters-in-law, and she's also helping Welga with some of these issues with these smart pills. She's a designer who works in that particular industry, which allowed me to go a little bit more in depth into the technology from that side. But she's also a mom. She's a wife. She has a home. She has a kid who's doing virtual school, which is a thing for everyone in 2095. I had no idea how relevant that was going to be either to people reading it right now.
Married to a Catholic of all things,
Right. And she's a Hindu, married to an American Catholic. And so, their relationship has to navigate these questions of, how do you raise a child? How do you conduct a relationship when you come from two very different cultures? This is a thing I have some personal experience with because, I am originally from India. I came to the US when I was a kid, so I've mostly grown up here. But I've married a white American born in America. And luckily, neither of us is religious. We're both atheists, so we don't have that particular conflict. But there's always cultural and value types of things that come up, right? As there is in any relationship. But I think it's more tricky when you're, from very disparate cultures. And I know other people who have been in these kinds of relationships, and it's really interesting to me to watch how they make it work. And so Nithya, I think, allowed me to kind of finally tell that story that I feel like I want more science fiction to tell. You know, she's got to navigate dinner. She's got to buy food. She's got to juggle her work schedules with her spouse and her daughter's school and social life. And how do you eat, sleep, and, you know, go about the day? And especially for something like Machinehood, that's really a story about work, right? And, you know, work in the future. I think it's important to show how a regular person works and lives and earns money.
I think it's, you know, and I know you didn't mean it necessarily this way, in the sense that, like, yeah, you know, Welga is definitely gets the hero parts, right? She gets the most tips after all. and I know that you didn't mean to exclude Nithya in that sort of conversation, because Nithya is a hero as far as I'm concerned too. You know, she quietly moves mountains instead of blowing them up, right? You know,
I think a lot of people do, right? Actually, I'm writing a blog post about it for someone right now. This idea of, like, the ordinary hero, you know, mm-hmm. that in the middle of a world crisis, let's say a pandemic, for example, there are people every day holding it together at home. They're not, you know, finding the cure for the virus. They're not out there on the front lines, but they're still dealing with a whole lot of stress and upheaval and still managing, right, to hold their families together, to keep people fed and keep the babies washed, you know, all of that stuff that's really important for the continuation of civilization.
Well, and her in particular too, which one of the things I loved was she didn't have to do any of this, right? I mean, she could have played it safe if she'd wanted to, but she risked her career, her marriage, friends, family, all that stuff, and made the courageous decision to act, right? The will to act is such a strong motivator for so many people, but when you have so much to lose, it tends to snuff that out sometimes. And she had a lot to lose, but she acted anyways, you know? And I just think that's so great with her. And she was one of my favorite, maybe my favorite character in the book. And I really loved, you know, the sacrifices she had to make. And with her friend and coworker Zelly, this incredible sort of, it's hard to talk about without spoilers, but I'll just say this sort of corruption they uncover, I guess, is maybe the least spoiler way to put it. Talk about, you know, angering this incredibly powerful, you know, system, right? That, you know, could snuff her out and it wouldn't even matter, right? It almost wouldn't even matter. But I think she's so brave for the decision she makes in this book. You know, from the personal sort of marriage dynamic decisions to, you know, the broader sort of, you know, decisions that, you know, of course, play into the entire narrative of the story. And while Welga is off, you know, being awesome, like you said, kicking ass and doing all those great things that she does in this story too. But I want to leave with maybe the most important character, and that's Papa, you know, to me has the most important line in the book. I'm going to ruin it. I don't remember what it was. Something about what happens when, pretty soon machines are going to start complaining too, right?
Right.
And that line comes from Oscar, right? And
Oscar.
Is there, I mean, I just, that just dawned on me. Just everything we've been talking about the last hour, right? Is there a more, it's such a simple way to put it, but it's, I don't know, there's a more profound question that's going to be facing us in the next decades to come. I agree. We probably will never get to that point. There'll be things in place, but if we do, I mean, is there a more profound question facing us, you know, in the next 50, 60 years? I don't know.
I think that is the question that will hopefully allow us to be appropriately prepared. Right.
Right. Right.
You know, one of the things a couple people have mentioned in the context of Machinehood in their reviews, which I absolutely love, is, Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics. I love that they mentioned it. I don't anymore love the Three Laws of Robotics. You know, I read a lot of Asimov in the 80s, mainly in 90s. And I thought, you know, it was very clever at the time. And I hear people who are actual software designers who are like, how do we codify the Three Laws of Robotics into our AI systems? And in 2020, that kind of horrifies me, because I think from an ethical standpoint, that's deeply unfair, because you're effectively pre-programming the robots to be slaves of humans forever,
sure.
Right?
Right.
Giving you're taking away their agency. And so it's like, if you did have a positronic brain that could somehow magically be conscious, wouldn't it be horrible to just like put in this, you know, hardware that says you can never act on your own. You must always act to protect human beings first. And so that's where I think this question, right? Like, you know, pretty soon the bots are going to start complaining too. Not if we don't let them. Right. If we don't let them program each other and evolve their programming in ways that fall outside our desires as human beings, then no, they're never going to complain, because we're not going to give them the opportunity to complain, much as we do, you know, with industrialized farming, right? There's not a whole lot the poor cows can do. So I'm going to say that now, knowing that you're a vegan, I presume you're on.
I might disagree. Yeah. The noises they make, I think, are pretty loud and clear to me, but anyways, yeah, that's a different discussion.
Yeah. Right. We can tell that the animals aren't happy about it, but it's like, too bad, you know, we need to eat meat. So,
I need my meat. That's
another hour long conversation.
Well, yeah, it's also, yeah. And that's the other thing too. It's an interesting one though. And like it did, because it comes up in your book too, right? About, you know, the way we treat all living creatures, or, you know, living, defined, quote unquote living, or, and just what's better for the planet, you know, in so many different ways. But again, you're right. That's a different, I brought it up in my review too. I said, talk about the manifesto. Think of Asimov's three laws of robotics, but if they'd been written by a machine with human level intelligence and he was familiar with the atrocities spread throughout human history. So you'd be bitter, right? If you were, let's just say you were a self-aware machine and it had access to the internet, you'd be like, what the F?
Yeah, exactly. that was the thing that drove me nuts about Ex Machina. The first like third of that movie, maybe even the first half, was so good, and set up so much stuff, and then I was unfortunately very disappointed with the third act, and where it went, because you know, supposedly the what was the name of the robot, I'm blanking,
Ava,
you said it earlier, yeah, Ava.
Yeah,
supposedly Ava has access to like all knowledge on the internet, right?
Yeah,
and that's how she finds out about murder. Hopefully I'm not spoiling it, but that's okay. And that's how she finds out about murder.
Now,
and so that's how she finally takes her revenge. And you know, humanity is so terrible. I'm like, okay, but did she read like all of the stuff on ethics and morality and all the good things human beings have done?
She skipped that
too?
Part. She skipped that part.
And you
part,
know how like murder is a crime and we actually think it's wrong. There's laws against it. Like, yeah, exactly. Like, did she skip over like those sections of the internet somehow? So it just got very preposterous, you know, in its descent into horror, and I guess its necessity to like promulgate that particular AI
narrative again,
right? I was just like, I didn't know what I was in for. I think I watched the movie fairly soon after it came out, and so I was very excited, because I was like, oh yeah, this is like this asking all these great questions, you know, in the beginning, and then I was just like, what? No.
Well, I definitely would
go through this again. Where
yeah,
just
I mean,
out
I would
to get us.
I'd love to take a pass at that ending. That's for sure. I would change a few things. There's no doubt. And you're right. I mean, is she just, you know, she gets on the helicopter. Does she murder the pilot when they land? Thinking like, does she go on this crazy murdering spree? Thinking she never got
what?
To
what's going
to
happen.
She never got to that letter in the encyclopedia. I guess right, like the laws or whatever. Yeah, but anyways, Divya. You know my thoughts on this book. I loved it. Yeah, I'd love to see, you know, I don't know what it would be called, but 2096, January 1st, you know, something like that. The day, you know, after what happens at the end there. Because I think it is, you know, like I said, in universe, this is, you know, like the marker, right, for them. Because so much is, you know, it gets to a point by the end of Machinehood where, you know, things are going to change in a very big and profound way for a lot of people, and once the gig is up anyways, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, in your mind, if you were able to tell that story, how would people react to, you know, just the concept of a Dakini, right?
Right.
Because that in again, in universe, in the world you've created, that seems to be the next step. So, right. it's a big step. It's a huge step, really. I'd love to see you, you know,
carry that forward.
Going. But that's, again, like you said, up to the public if they pick this book up, and then we'll go from there. It's for sale now. Everyone, please buy this book however you can. I'd prefer you didn't do it through a pandemic profiteer, but if you don't have access to a local indie place, then get it however you can. SBTV.com is your website. Machinehood.com
for some fun.
Thank you so much. I really love that you took the time, and I'm sorry I kept you so long. I could keep going, but yeah,
I have no doubt. Absolutely, my pleasure.
Better things to do. So please enjoy the rest of your day and your weekend, and please continue to be safe. There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Divya for coming on the show. As you can tell, I had a great time not only talking about Machinehood, but the questions the book asks us to consider as a species on this planet going forward. It's definitely my idea of a good time, and I can't recommend this book enough. Head on over to sbdivya.com to find out more, including how you can get your hands on this book. Also, check out escapepod.org, the sci-fi podcast Divya is a part of, along with Mer Lafferty. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest TV, movie, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.